From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jonathan Last's new book is going to challenge some conventional wisdom, challenge the concept that the world is filling up with people at an unsustainable rate. In fact, he says, from Africa to Asia, from South America to Eastern Europe, from the developing world to the Mideast, nearly every country and every region of the planet is experiencing a decline in fertility. For two generations now, he says, the population has been slowing, and he says this is bad, especially if you look at human history. Any time in the past when the population shrunk, bad things happened. Disease, economic stagnation, war. Today in the program, Jonathan Last is joining us to describe America's part in the story. His book is called What to Expect When No One is Expecting. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Jonathan Last knew he would be taking on some deeply held notions about population with his new book. Just the idea itself that people around the world are having too few babies is going to challenge some conventional thinking. And there are more than a few provocative comments in here. He calls Paul Ehrlich's popular 1968 book, The Population Bomb, spectacularly foolish. He says the U.S. has created its own one-child policy, not unlike China's. But the point of the book is not to provoke, in fact, but to explore the reason for this population trend of declining fertility that he documents in nearly every country and every region of the world. The focus of the book is on the U.S. It's called What to Expect When No One is Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. And Jonathan Last is joining us today to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jonathan Last is a senior writer for the Weekly Standard. He's also been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and many others. He's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. And Jonathan Last, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. You make it all sound so much more exciting than it really is. Provocative, challenging. I'm glad you didn't say it's just full of math and numbers.
Well, it is full of math and numbers.
What people want to hear.
But what did you expect? Let me start with that idea that, I mean, there are some things that are going to be seen as provocative. Certainly when we get to some of the things that you're thinking about in terms of solutions for dealing with some of this. You knew you were taking on some conventional wisdom here, of course.
I did. And, you know, of course, I took some sucker in the fact that I'm not the first to do this. Yeah. You know, I came to this book actually after a good friend of mine, a progressive demographer named Philip Longman, who is at the New America Foundation here in Washington, who wrote a book on demographics about 7 or 8 years ago, which kind of hooked me on the junk. And I always tell people everyone should own two books about demographics and they should buy mine and Phil's. But if you're only going to buy one, go buy Phil's. It's called The Empty Cradle and it's better. But what I found interesting is I read Phil's book and his is a popular book in the way that mine is. And what I found interesting is I started tumbling down the rabbit hole. All of the conventional wisdom is really just – it's the popularly held wisdom.
Yeah.
Out in the academic world, you know, if you go to the demographics unit at the European Commission, you go to the demographics unit at the United Nations, you go look at the various population research programs they have in universities across the country and in Europe, frankly, and in Asia, there's almost zero disagreement. All of those people, their numbers, their research all points in the same direction. And so all I've really done is gone and read a lot of academic literature and just tried to like take it and distill it and put it in a way that normal people who are not freaks of nature and insufferable bores like myself can, you know, sit and make it through a few pages at a time before their eyes glaze over and they fall asleep.
Well, you begin with a completely relatable story at the beginning. It's an observation, really, from a place where you used to live with your wife, your family. And you noticed as you were going through this that the country seemed to be going through this transition. And it was this focus that you discovered sort of on pets, a pet boom, which you say reflects a trend in other parts of the world, too. Talk about this, because this is how you sort of begin the book.
Yeah, so I used to live in this little suburb of Washington, D.C. on the Virginia side. It's called Old Town Alexandria. And if you come south along the Potomac River, it's the first town. It's actually where Washington, D.C. was originally settled. And then they moved it further north into the swamps, which was foolish then. But, you know, what are you going to do? And anyway, it's this wonderful sort of perfect town. It almost looks like a Disney preserve. You know, you have these cobblestone streets. Everything there was built in like 1750. And it's just almost like the platonic ideal of where to live in a suburb, you know. And it's an old suburb. You walk everywhere. You walk to the grocery store. You walk to the market. You walk to a bar or a pub or to a restaurant for dinner. And my wife and I lived there. We were both in our late 20s. We really enjoyed our lives there. And what we found was, though, as we started thinking about family life, is there weren't very many kids there. And what there are were a whole lot of dogs. And anyway, I begin the book talking about this little development that they put in behind our condo right across from the river. And this condo, this development had all sorts of stuff that you would think, right? It had a very hip gastro pub. It had this sensational coffee shop and bakery. And it had a hair salon and a Russian gourmet market, a dry cleaner. And they also had a children's clothing store. And the children's clothing store went out of business after about a year and a half, and it was replaced by a doggy spa. And this left my little corner of the world, Old Town, at that point, with only two stores which sold toys and clothes for children. And I think the count was at that point then six stores which sold, you know, either organic bakery doggy treats or, you know, doggy spa and grooming aid stuff. And that's because people in Old Town had dogs and not children.
Yeah. Which, did you put two and two together at the point?
Yeah, well, you know, as we started trying to figure out how we could possibly afford to still live there and had a child, it became obvious to, oh, that's why they have dogs. Because, you know, it's really expensive to have a kid in America. And this is, it's not just expensive, it is relatively much more expensive than it was two generations ago. And in a place like Old Town, where the land costs are quite high, I mean, to have even where we were living, to have even a very modest townhome, really requires the salaries of two full-time professionals. You know, you need two lawyers, basically, or a lawyer and a lobbyist, just to afford what's basically like maybe a 2,000, 2,100 square foot townhome. And it's hard to raise kids like that. We had this little, very charming condominium, and we had our first child while we were living there, and we did about a year in the condo, and we realized at the end of that year that if we didn't move in about a week, somebody was going to die. all three of us were not making it out of that condo if we didn't get the heck out of Dodge. And so that's what we did, and we moved out to the exurbs, which are every bit as horrible and soulless as everybody says they are.
Right.
But on the other hand, they make it easier to have kids.
Yeah, well, this is a point that you make early on in the book, and I wanted to get some of these things out of the way. First of all, that as you say, you're not trying to convince people necessarily to have babies, or certainly not trying to sentimentalize the experience of having kids.
No, not at all. Like my wife frequently says to me when I come back from Disney on this book tour, and she says, you know, you shouldn't make it sound so bad. And I say, well, but
hello.
I do not sentimentalize children at all. They are wonderful in their own way. But on the other hand, they're a whole lot of work. A lot of the work is deeply unpleasant. And I say this over and over again. I am not here to judge people who don't want to have kids. I'm not even here to argue them into having kids. I celebrate those choices. Go forth, see a movie on a Wednesday night, and think about me as you stay out late. But on the other hand, when we look at the situation we're here in America, our problem actually is quite fortunate in that it isn't that people don't want children anymore. I mean, there is a certain segment of the population which has decided they would like to be child-free.
Yeah.
And that is a new development historically. We now have about 10 or 15% of people who don't want to have kids. But that's not the median experience, actually. The sort of the median experience in America is, oddly enough, very much the same as it was two generations ago. It's very similar to what it was in 1970. And so that's why I think that it's useful. I think it's useful to talk about these things, I think, because they're interesting and there's a lot of things for people to learn. But, you know, when we come to talking about policy, it isn't about, you know, demonizing or villainizing the people who don't want to have kids. It's not about, like, beating them over the heads and saying, oh, you bad, selfish people, you ought to bite down on a stick and have a baby. It's really, we ought to be looking at how to make life easier for the people who do want children and, you know, let them go out and do the heavy lifting.
Mm. Another one of these caveats I wanted to move out of the way was that a lot of the times this issue is seen as a critique of modern women. You're not interested in that part either.
No, I'm really not. And I, you know, God knows, my wife went to Smith College, this very progressive all-women's school up in Massachusetts. My wife works. She has a sort of high power, awesome job, and much more high power and much more awesome than my stupid journalism job. But I really think, you know, when you look at the demographic stuff, if you're going to sort of have an honest conversation about everything, you need to be able to actually look at things and, you know, call them for what they are and look at the research and recognize it for what it is. And you always have to understand that, you know, just because you like something on balance doesn't mean that it's free. You know, just because we like the outcomes in general from a certain change in modern life doesn't mean that every single outcome that comes from it has been beneficial. And so I just think it's useful to talk about things honestly and look at, you know, what the costs are and what the debits are and be able to just sort of talk about them. And, you know, hopefully everybody comes to the table in a place of good faith and, you know, doesn't immediately jump and say, oh, you must hate women. But because I don't hate women. I, you know, I have two daughters. I hope they grow up to be successful and happy and all that. And, you know, but at the same time, the changes we've had in modern life over the last 50 or 60 years, a lot of which have had to do with the role of women in the world and the opportunities afforded to them, they've carried lots of changes that have to do with our fertility and demographics.
Mm. I wanted to talk about, you write about the book, I mentioned this in the introduction, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb. What did Ehrlich get wrong? I mean, you say that pretty much he got most everything wrong, but how did he get it so wrong, do you think?
Yeah, he really does get everything wrong. Yeah, I would say the first thing he does, which irks me, is something that just sort of irks me in general. And I always try to warn audiences. Anybody who talks to you as if they have just gotten back out of a steaming DeLorean from 50 years into the future and that they are reporting to you firsthand what the future looks like, you should automatically distrust them because nobody knows what the future looks like, right? I mean, we have trend lines, we have data, and we like to, you know, you want to make the most of them. You don't stick your head in the sand and ignore them. But on the other hand, trends change, things mm-hmm. change. And you should always, I think, really be very, very wary of people who don't cop to that, people who aren't sort of humble about what their data says, and who talk as if they have a crystal ball from which they have glimpsed the future through the eye of God. And that's what Ehrlich's book does. I mean, on every page, he's talking with dead certitude about mm-hmm. what is going to happen in the future. And so he was incredibly certain, I would say not at all modest in sort of the understanding the limits of his social science. And he turned out to be very wrong. I mean, what he was selling, what his prediction was that, you know, fertility rates are exceedingly high, they're going to stay exceedingly high for forever, and that as a result of this, we were going to have mass starvations. And he said, you know, within just a handful of years, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of people starving to death, no matter what we do now, there is nothing that can be done to stop this. And, you know, basically none of that came to pass. You know, none of those starvations and famines happened because we had what they call in the agriculture industry the Green Revolution in agriculture. And that made it so that we no longer really have famines anymore. We certainly have hunger problems, but where they are, these are basically man-made, and they are often places where, you know, corrupt regimes are trying to punish their own people. Mm. That's not a resource problem. That's a political problem. And the other thing that happened is, and this was what makes his book sort of particularly wrong, is that at the moment he was writing it, is the moment that fertility collapse was beginning. And it began in the West, and then it spread throughout the rest of the world. And so, you know, basically his entire thesis wound up being exactly pointed in the opposite direction. And I think it wound up being a very harmful book because, I mean, what you have to realize is that then throughout the 70s and the 80s, when his book really dominated the popular consciousness, I mean, he was a guest on the Johnny Carson show. I mean, younger people may not even remember who Johnny Carson was. But, I mean, Paul Ehrlich, you know, Johnny Carson, just have him pull up a chair and come and sit and talk about how we were all doomed because everyone was going to starve to death because there were too many people. But as he was doing that and running that sort of dog and pony show through the 70s and 80s, the state of the art in the research, all of the academic work in this, was looking at the opposite problem. Everybody was studying the fertility implosion and trying to figure out what it was and why it was and where it came from. And so you had this real disconnect between the academic world of people looking at the data and then the sort of popular world of people who were just looking at Ehrlich's book. And to a large degree, his book still dominates. And I think he sold 2 or maybe even 3 million copies of it. And so part of it also is just, you know, rank jealousy on my part because I've not sold 2 million copies. And so it's a green-eyed monster, and I'm sitting here looking, oh, that Paul Ehrlich. Too many people bought his book.
Well, do you think it seems like in some way the thing that he didn't take into account, I mean, aside from maybe some other failings, was human adaptation, the way we reacted to the changes in demographics, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say what's going on. I mean, the real mystery of the fertility decline, you know, so it began in the West. It began in the developed world. And so for most of the 70s and 80s, the question was, what is happening in the developed world? And the question was, what is it about liberalism? And I don't mean like you know, Democrat liberal. I just mean like the Western liberal project that causes people to lose hope in the, you know, and wind up stopping having babies. But then very quietly in the late 80s and 90s, that spread then worldwide. So now you see it in Central America. You see it in South America. A lot of people don't realize Iran's fertility rate today is lower than our fertility rate in the United States is. I mean, it's global. So we have 97% of the world's population now lives in a country where the fertility rate is declining. And all the projections, you know, from places like, you know, the United Nations and various academic departments across the country and across the world, are that global population is going to peak sometime in the next 50 or 60 years, probably someplace around, you know, 9 billion or so, give or take, and then going to begin declining. Then the question becomes, well, how far does it decline? How fast does it decline? And that we don't know because we don't know where the fertility rates go, you know. And so it's very interesting. There are all sorts of developments going on here and all sorts of changes. And some of them are about systems and some of them are about people, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And some of them are about economic systems and some of them are about attitudes of people and cultural things themselves.
Yeah, which we'll get to. I want to talk about all of the particulars of that because I think it's interesting. We should get to the numbers themselves, I suppose, so you can sort of talk about it in that context. One is this golden number. You write in the book that in order for a country to maintain a steady population, it needs a fertility rate of 2.1. If that rate is higher, the country's population grows. If the rate is lower, the population shrinks. And it's, for some perspective, you mentioned Japan and Italy, for example, because they're on the shrinking end of that golden number. They're in a real spiral, is how you refer to it. Talk about that golden number to get us oriented.
Sure. So the metric that I talk about a lot throughout the book is called the total fertility rate.
Right.
And the total fertility rate is the average number of children that the average woman in a society has over the course of her lifetime. Now, I always tell people, you have to realize that the total fertility rate is a statistical construct. And what it is, it's a statistical construct that is designed to give you a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. So it's not inviolable. I mean, it's not the hardest of hard numbers. If you are really obsessed with this stuff and you want the hardest number imaginable, what you really want is what's called the cohort, a completed cohort fertility number. But the problem with those things is you can't get them until 40 years after a group of women is born. And so they're a little bit hard. Those are very lagging and it's hard to get at them.
Yeah.
So I always, you know, I caution people by saying, look, understand, you know, the line about statistics, you know, and lies, damned lies in statistics. It's all totally true when it comes to demographics, too. And so, you know, we look at fertility rates and we're never obsessing about a hundredth of a point here or a hundredth of a point there. What we're really looking to do is really look from 30,000 feet, look at trends, right? You want to look at the big picture and not get hung up on small things. And so our golden number is the total fertility rate of 2.1, which is the replacement rate. And people say, why do you need the extra 0.1? And the reason you need 0.1 is because you have people who are infertile and then you have people who die before they complete their childbearing years.
Yeah.
And so to sort of make up for those two things, you need to have 2.1 babies per woman in order to keep your population stable. And so we are just below that here in America. We're about 1.93 right now. In Europe, the average is about 1.6.
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, they're much lower than that. In Japan, they're much lower than that. There are places still lower than those. And in those places, you see, after about 40 or 50 years of sustained low fertility, you wind up seeing population shrinkage. And that's where Japan is now. That's where lots of countries actually already are. Germany already is. And it's where we could be headed in the future. I mean, I would say where we are right now, that 1.93, is actually pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And if I thought that 1.93 was sustainable, I wouldn't be at all worried, and neither would be the specialists who study this stuff. The reason we're concerned, the royal we here, is that it seems as though that 1.93 is a way station and not a stopping point for us. And if that does turn out to be the case, then we're going to wind up seeing some ill effects.
Well, explain what you mean, because let's break that down. Because let's look at whites and blacks, for example. Black women are at 1.96. White women, 1.79. But the boost that's getting us to that 1.93 is coming from Hispanic women who have a fertility rate, you point out, 2.35. And you write this, that if you take out Hispanics out of the equation, America's fertility picture looks really different. Now, maybe we should get another one of these caveats out of the way, this question of race, because people are going to that whole question of so what you're saying is we're going to start filling the country with illegal immigrants because Hispanics are more fertile than we Americans or whatever that is. Get that out of the way, if you would, Jonathan Laston. Put that Hispanic number in figure, because it is that figure in context, if you would, because it's an important one.
Sure. I mean, so the reason a minute ago I said that we believe that what we're seeing right now is a way station, right, not an end point.
Yeah.
And the reason we think that is because we are so dependent on Hispanic fertility for our fertility boost. And the problem is that Hispanics may not always continue to act the way they have been acting in the very recent past. When
yeah.
you break out the Hispanic fertility numbers, you see that all Americans are experiencing fertility decline. You know, our average fertility is moving downward in America, but the rate at which Hispanics are having their fertility diminish is multiples of what the general population is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for instance, demographers measure what is called the education effect. And so that is, you know, for every year of education a woman has, her fertility will wind up going down by some given percentage. The education effect on Hispanics is 9 times what it is for the general population in America. Mm-hmm. So all of this suggests that there's enormous downward pressure on Hispanic fertility, and that we are not going to be able to rely on them for the boost that we have been getting over the last 30 years indefinitely. And so that's really, when I talk about the problem of Hispanic fertility generally, what I mean is that we get Hispanics who come here with very elevated fertility levels and that they get ground down very, very quickly. Mm. And so there's a lot of research looking at the question of how long is it before Hispanic American fertility is what it is for everybody else
right.
here. And the answers on that range anywhere from, 10 to 15 years to like 50 to 60 years. But the answer is it's going to be there eventually. It's a when, not an if question. And so that's really the problem of Hispanic fertility, is that without them, we wind up looking more like Europe. And the problem is we're going to wind up looking more like Europe if they continue to follow the pattern of fertility declines themselves that they have already.
Well, there are two questions we're going to work through as we come back from a break we'll take here in a moment. One is, why? How did we get to this point? What are the factors that come into play, which you write about, of course? And then so what? So what if the population declines, the fertility rate declines? What's the consequence? What's the implication? Jonathan Last is with us. His book is called What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. And you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about population. Our guest, the journalist Jonathan Last, says, in essence, we're not having enough babies. He's written a book that explores the impact of falling fertility rates around the world. Among the stranger results that he writes about are things like adult diapers outselling baby diapers, pets outnumbering children. Last says this decline in fertility has serious consequences, which we're going to talk about. His book is called What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. And you can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. This surprised me, Jonathan Last. Fertility rate in this country has been falling since in fact, the country was founded.
I know. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, if you look at the trend line going back to 1800, which is when we get our first good demographic numbers, because we had our first census back then, you see basically an uninterrupted line going downward. We were at about a 7 fertility rate back in 1800, about 1.93 today. There's been only one moment of sustained increase, and everybody knows what that is.
Yeah,
that was the baby boom.
Yeah.
And so we had 22 years when the fertility rate just about doubled. Now, I would just say as a quick aside here, this is, I think, a perfect example of why I think we should always be very modest about projecting deep into the future, right? Mm-hmm. So if I had sat and said to you in 1944,
yeah.
Beginning in 2 years, the fertility rate is going to double and it's going to stay doubled for 22 years, you would have said, you're crazy.
Yeah.
There's no historical precedent for that. There's no reason to believe that that is going to be true. But it did happen. And so this is, you know, trends get interrupted, things reverse. And so that's, people are still trying to figure out exactly where the baby boom came from. We really don't have a very good grasp on it. We have some ideas, but these ideas don't really fully explain what happened during the baby boom. And so, you know, it's a very complicated, very, very complicated system. And we understand it in fits and starts, but it, it's very hard to really get your arms all the way around.
But you also say, though, that all of the next generation's parents have already been born. So that does give us a sense of kind of where we're headed.
It does. And so this is why I say that the question then becomes, the variable then becomes behavior.
Right.
So we know, for the next like two generations worth of parents, we know how many potential parents there are. We don't know what their fertility rate is going to be. And so, for instance, when you look at a country like Italy or Poland, when we're working out what their future demographic projections are, we can do that by fertility rate. We can say, okay, so if fertility rate is constant, this is how many people there will be in 40 years. If the fertility rate goes up to the replacement level, this is how many people. If the fertility rate were to, for some reason, triple, for instance, we could say this is, because again, we know how many parents there are. The only variable there really is the fertility behavior.
Right. Well, let's get to some of these reasons why. There are a lot of factors, as you mentioned, that are playing out here. Among them, let me just sort of, one you mention is, let me take a call because I think it'll get us there. Clarissa is joining us in Draper, Utah. Clarissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm curious, I heard you label people moving into the country as Hispanic, but I'm wondering if you've looked at, when I think of people moving in from Central and South America, I think of the religious Catholic base, which has a lot to do with how many children you have when fertility is frowned upon in your religion. Have you considered religion in this factor?
Oh boy, have I.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to talk about, because this is a factor, of course, playing out.
Yeah, fertility looms very large, Clarissa. And in fact, there's a great book by a guy named Eric Kaufman called Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth, which looks at, this is essentially a slightly complicated mathematical problem, which looks at three, if I can hearken you back to your high school calculus, to three rate changes, three rate differentials, dx, dt, if you can remember that. And that is the difference between the fertility rate of believers and non-believers. Believers tend to have more children than non-believers do. Then the pass-on rate of religious belief. So, you know, if you have five children and you're a religious believer, how many of your kids wind up also of faith? And then the attrition rate, which is to say, you know, for every given 100 believers, how many of them fall away during their adult times? And what Kaufman suggests is that when you work those equations, we may be looking at the high watermark of secularism in America right now, because religious believers have more kids. They tend to pass on their religious belief at very, very high rates, and they don't fall away at as high a rate as you might think. And so when you combine all of that with the largely Catholic immigration we've been getting from Central and South America, that we actually may be headed towards a more religiously orthodox country in over the next 30 years or so. But, you know, the most interesting thing about religion that I found, and something that I was very surprised about, was that if you go back and you look at the data from the early 20th century, you go back to 1900, 1910, there were enormous fertility differentials by religious sect, which is to say that Mormons had the most kids, Catholics were behind them, then Protestants, and then Jews, and then nuns, not N-U-N, but N-O-N-E, the people who actually didn't have religious adherence. And then in the 50s and 60s, those sectarian differences began shrinking and then gradually disappearing. And today what we have is not a real sectarian difference in fertility, but a religiosity difference in fertility, which is to say, what matters now isn't what you believe. What matters is how often you show up to church.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if you are Mormon or Unitarian or Baptist or Jewish. What matters is how often you attend services. And I find that really fascinating and evocative, I think. And it, I think, speaks to, in some sort of, you know, deep, deep way, what it is that gets people off the bench and into the game of having kids.
And religious participation is declining, which is why fertility rates are, that you say is one of the,
right,
one of the factors.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Clarissa, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. You know, you do point out, for example, this was interesting. 2008, Utah had the highest total fertility rate in the country. I mean, that's been the case for a long time, 2.6. Vermont, you look at the other side, had the lowest, 1.67. 55% difference. So how much does region and demography play out? When you're talking about the West, you're talking about higher fertility rates. Say something about that, if you would.
You know, it's so important. And I think, you know, we tend to think of the United States as if it's one big coherent whole, and it is in many ways. But when it comes to fertility, it really isn't. And I I think the most striking analogy I could make is that the difference between Utah and Vermont in terms of fertility behavior is bigger than the difference between the highest fertility country in Europe, which is France, I believe, and the lowest fertility country, which is, I believe, Luxembourg, although you probably have my book in front of you and I don't. And so when you think about the cultural differences between the different European countries, and you think about how different those places really are, how different the people really are, and then you imagine that, you know, well, here in America, when it comes to fertility behavior, at least, we are even more dissimilar and more different from one another than they are. I mean, that really shows, I think, how dissimilar we are, at least in this regard. And certainly some of that is tied to economics and just land costs. You know, it is cheaper to live in Utah than it is to live in Manhattan. But some of it is tied to culture as well. And I think, you know, we think about the culture of Utah. The culture of Utah is really quite a lot different from the culture of Vermont.
So what do you mean, do you think, by culture? Are you talking about, if you look at some of the dynamics that sort of play into why fertility rates are declining, ubiquity of college, for example, the delay of marriage, the birth control pill, there's a lot about that you write, religious participation is one, which we just talked about. What is the cultural dynamic there? Just a higher level of sophistication, can we say, that somehow contributes to some kind of aversion to having kids?
You know, I don't know if it's sophistication. I think it's to a large extent difference in priorities. Huh. I think it's difference in sort of the importance of family formation, you know, how family formation is viewed, whether it is something which is not imperative maybe, but certainly like a really important goal, you know, something to be pursued at least as vigorously as one would pursue going to college and having a good job. I think those emphases are probably quite different in Utah. I look at, you guys know this better than I do, but I look at and talk a little bit about BYU in my book.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things BYU does, which sounds insane if you talk to another college administrator, is that they have housing for married students. And they make it so that, not a few BYU students both get married while they're in college, but then even have a kid while they're in college. Mm-hmm. If you were to go and talk to the kids at Yale about that and say, so would you like married student housing so you could start a family while you're here? They would look at you like you had five heads.
Right.
They'd say, that's not what college is for. Yeah. College is for getting drunk and throwing up and cleaning up after people. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, actually having a kid is quite a lot like that. But this is, I think, exactly what I'm trying to get at, which is the idea of, you know, just slightly different priorities. You know, it is important. People go to BYU, go to the Y, are doing so because they think it's important to go to college, that a college education is important.
Yeah.
But while they're understanding that family formation is important as well. And, you know, people aren't being frog marched into marriage and parenthood, but the people who want to do that and are ready to do that, the system is set up to help them and accommodate them in a way which, in other parts of the country, it's basically unheard of, and it sounds crazy.
Mm. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Clarissa, thanks very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Mark is with us in Riverton, Utah. Mark, welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just wondering if the author understands that we've already proven that life is sustainable of 5 billion people on Earth. And does he take in the consequences of a longer longevity of life? So the population that we have now is not the same as having 5 billion people 100 years ago because they didn't use nearly as much energy or resources. And the more people we have, and especially in this age of instant communications, the poor people are going to live the same lifestyles that America has. And can we afford, the world can afford to have that kind of lifestyle? And all we doing is having more people to create cheaper labor to support those wealthy people.
Mm. All right, hold that thought for just a moment, Mark, because I want to throw another comment into the mix, which sort of gets there as well. Joe, who writes, decreasing fertility rates means we have a modest chance of approaching population stability, which he writes is necessary to avoid environmental and economic collapse. Our planet's critical challenge is to transition to a truly sustainable, no-growth economy. Rather than talk about decline, let's talk about opportunity. So they're not entirely the same, but they deal with this concern about environmental and economic collapse if we keep growing at the same rate. Respond to those if you can.
Sure. I am not one of those guys who thinks that we need to be Nigeria with, a fertility rate of 6 and, constant growth, where we double every 30 years or something. The point of what I say in my book often is that what we really want to get to is a stable population. And the reason we want a stable population is because of, this is sort of, we're getting into complicated math, but I ask you to bear with me.
Yeah.
So the first thing that happens when your fertility rate is below replacement is that the age structure of your population inverts, and you wind up with more old people than young people. And it is the age structure which concerns us much more than overall population number, right, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
If the question was, could we cut a billion people off of the planet sort of, at a shot, but our age structure stayed at the same ratios, then we would say, okay, well, then population decline isn't so bad. That's something we could manage with. The problem is the inversion, mm-hmm, right? Because when you have many more old people than young people, you wind up, this is what leads to economic stagnation. This is what leads to all sorts of instability and problems. You just think about, just as a for instance, the big entitlement problem we have here in America, the problem with Social Security and Medicare, that is demographic driven. It is because we wind up with many fewer workers for many more retirees. And when you sort of then write that large, this is what caused the problems world over. And so while we have these pension problems basically here and, and in Japan and in Europe, in first world countries that are rich, you can make those things work. You have to inflict some pain. People who are promised things don't get those promises. But, on the whole, you're not really risking revolution. Mm-hmm. But when these things happen in the developing world, as they are going to, you actually wind up with a lot of human misery. Having an inverted age structure in Bangladesh where you do not have enough resources and enough people to care for the elderly, mm-hmm, that's a very different thing than it is here in America, where we're worried about, will taxes have to go up on young workers, or will we have to means test Social Security? Do you see what I'm saying? So, it is a human misery thing. Now, this is why I say in the book, what we're worried about here is not jacking the fertility rate to the moon. What we're worried about is trying to get us to that golden number, trying to get us to 2.1, because if you sustain at 2.1, then your age ratio winds up stabilizing, and then you can make plans going forward. I would say to Mark's question, Mark was asking really a carrying capacity question.
Yeah.
A lot of people who are into the environment worry about that. There's really no good research on carrying capacity. Nobody really knows what the carrying capacity of the planet is. I mean, I would say that we could all stipulate that, one bazillion trillion people would be too many, and we probably would not have enough resources for that. However, in the very near term, because what we think we're seeing is a peak somewhere around 9 billion and then going backwards, we're not looking at 100 trillion people. We're looking at about 9 billion and then going backwards. And that cake is... So much as we can tell, we think that cake is already baked, basically. I would always tell people who worry about overpopulation that we have been hearing about the perils of overpopulation for 200 years now. Mm-hmm. The first guy to ring that bell was Thomas Malthus. And it has been rung at various times, basically constant, various times, pretty much in various places, pretty much consistently for 200 years. And it's always the same. We don't have enough resources. People are going to starve. We're going to have human misery. The planet can't take it. And at every turn, those predictions always just get pushed further out on the horizon. We never quite get there. And instead, what you have, in fact, is that you have human life expectancy more than doubling. Mm-hmm. You have the standard of living increasing across the world, even the developing world, so that people now live better than they did 200 years ago. When you look at its resources and scarcity, a very good measure of scarcity is prices. And if you look at prices of commodities over the last 100 years, they've actually dropped an average of 1% a year for the last century. Mm. And so this is happening even though the population of the planet has tripled. And so you would think to yourself, if that argument was true, why wouldn't all those prices be going up? And the reason they're not is there's actually a lot of economics research on this. If you look at Julian Simon and Esther Bothrop, what their work suggests is that you have human ingenuity, and human ingenuity leads to technological advance. And because technological advances are cumulative, you're able to build over time and conserve over time. And this is why, we have the Green Revolution in agriculture. It's why life expectancy has increased. I would say I myself don't have a whole lot of concern about overpopulation because, as I said, all the indicators seem to be going the other way. Mm. If we looked like we were headed towards a global fertility rate of 6 for the foreseeable future, then we could have that discussion, I suppose. But we seem to be heading the opposite direction. I think that certainly the more present concern is what happens as the low fertility causes our age pyramid to invert, so we wind up with many more old people than young people, and the attendant stresses that brings.
But what does happen? I mean, because in general, you say, when you look at human history, anytime you've had declining populations, bad things have followed: disease and war and economic stagnation. But it seems like the response you've been getting from some is that disease, that was an issue of another time. I mean, it's not to say there won't always be disease, but you know, we're at a more advanced sort of civilization. Economic stagnation isn't necessarily in play because the global economy is expanding. So what's the bad thing that's going to happen when fertility rates decline, when population implodes?
Well, I think economic stagnation is very much in play. I mean, when you look at Japan, you look at where Japan is now, you have to be of a certain age to remember when Japan was going to take over the world. But throughout the 70s and 80s, Japan was going to conquer everything. I mean, we were told that if you wanted to have a job in the year 2000, you were going to have to speak Japanese. The Japanese were buying up property in Manhattan. They owned 30 Rock Center and Rockefeller Plaza. And even then, in 1984, Japan's demographers were warning the country that they did not have the demographic profile to sustain their growth. And nobody listened to them. And then in the 90s, Japan went into recession. Mm-hmm. They thought it was a lost decade, and they're now in the 23rd year of their lost decade. And there's broad agreement among both the demographers and the economists in Japan that what they're experiencing is a demographic recession. Because what happens is your capital pools begin to shift. They go more towards older people who are drawing down resources, who are spending money instead of investing it. It becomes harder to have with smaller and shallower capital pools. It's harder for entrepreneurs and risk takers to find investment to back them. It's harder to have a dynamic economy. And so you wind up all of those things happening at the same time that the demand on public resources in the form of pensions and Social Security and Medicare programs are being really, really stressed. Now, as I said, if this was just a Western problem, if this was 1970 and we were just looking around and we only thought that it was the West that was in this problem, then we would say, okay, well, you know what? Europe will figure it out. Japan will figure it out. America will figure it out. And they may be in for 30 or 40 rough years. But, you know, so be it. They'll be in for 30 or 40 rough years and everything will be fine. The problem is that because this is a global phenomenon and because we're going to watch countries one after another ticking over that into decline, ticking over with their age structures inverted, and because there are poor countries and unstable countries as well, they're going to have this happen to them. You worry about what happens to the global order. Now, really, I'm not a doom monger, I promise you, but I think it's not hard to envision what happens. It's not hard to envision bad outcomes in China. If you look at China right now, with a very low fertility rate, they have at this point, they're looking down the barrel of the next 30 years or so of having about 300 million retirees with nobody to support them because they don't really have a pension system. Because of the one-child policy, they don't really have children to support them and take care of them. And so what does the autocratic, somewhat unstable government in China do? You know, do they radically raise taxes on workers in order to pay for these old people? Do they take these old people, send them out to the countryside to die the way they did during the Cultural Revolution? If they do either of these things, do they risk revolution themselves? Mm-hmm. You could just see instability sort of is inherent in these things, you know. The week my book came out, in Japan, the country's finance minister came out and he said it was time for the country's old people to hurry up and die. And he didn't lose his job for this.
Yeah.
You know, you are seeding the seeds of generational conflict once you sort of end up with that inverted population pyramid. And I think that in any one country, you would say this isn't a problem. But with basically everybody heading in the same direction, it becomes easier and easier to see how, well, somebody's going to wind up unstable and the world itself could reorder itself in ways that we might not like.
Jonathan Last is with us. His book is called What to Expect When No One's Expecting: America's Coming Demographic Disaster. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Jonathan Last. We're talking about his book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting: America's Coming Demographic Disaster. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Lynette is with us in Murray, Utah. Lynette, hi.
Hi. I want to assert the last caller's point once again, because when he says that the Earth cannot support this kind of population, the guest's response is the prices are going down. I don't see any connection between prices going down and the fact that our oceans are acidifying and our forests are getting decimated. And, for example, last night on PBS there was a show on elephants that, I don't know, 100 or so years ago there were 10 million elephants, and now they're down to 600,000 or so. And all of our ecosystems are systems. They have to network together, and we're losing the whole network. And so I just think the guest has dismissed the previous caller's very, very important point without really addressing it. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Jonathan, last, to that bigger environmental implication question.
Yeah, you know, I don't quite know. When I talk about prices, the reason we talk about prices is because prices are a measure of scarcity. Right. And so if something is more scarce, the price of it goes up. It's as close as we can get to an objective measure of resource scarcity. And so when people tell us that, you know, we don't have enough resources, well, when we look at prices of these things, we see the prices going down. I think that is a pretty objective demonstration that, in fact, we do have the resources. It becomes very difficult, I think, to gauge the less data-driven aspects of whether or not there are enough people or too many people, or, you know, whether the environment is really being degraded. I mean, look back at America during the 1970s, and America was really, we were in rough shape, right? We had acid rain, our lakes and rivers were terribly polluted. We had smog in major cities, really raw sewage in places like the Delaware River outside of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Cleveland, remember the lake was on fire outside of Cleveland. I would say in nearly every measure, America's environment is better off and cleaner and more sustainable today than it was in 1970. And that is because of the number of choices that we made. And it is also because we got richer and we had the luxury to go and make choices to make our environment better. In a lot of ways, environmentalism is a luxury good. So I think you can't simply assert then it follows, you know, so the American population has doubled since 1970. Why has our environment gotten better here in America and not worse? You can't simply say it, you know, it follows that as population increases, you know, because of X, Y must happen. That isn't the way these systems actually work.
Lynette, thanks. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number two. Join the conversation. I wanted to ask you about, we had the economist Brian Kaplan on the program, and he agrees with your conclusion, but he's written about your book. And he says that Americans, yes, they should be having more children. But he did quibble with certain things, among them the language, and for example, in the subtitle of your book, Disaster. Kaplan says, look, we may be experiencing a decline in lifestyle. Our taxes may go up. But he says that's hardly a disaster. How do you respond to that?
I don't know if I count Brian as a friend. I know Brian a little bit. So I don't want to say anything really bad about what an idiot Brian. No, I'm kidding. Brian's not an idiot. He's very, very smart. And his book about this stuff is actually very good. I don't know. I mean, it says in the subtitle, Disaster, the whole book itself is slightly tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I like to think, if I have any pride in the book, I like to think that it's the funniest book ever written about demographics.
Right.
And, you know, I say over and over in the book, you know, both really, look, you know, I'm not saying we're doomed. I'm not a doomsayer. I try to be very modular. I mean, I don't say that the human species is going extinct. What I'm saying is we're going to wind up with declining lifestyles, the possibility of real instability, both economic, social, and political, because none of us really know the future. I mean, I would say I get dinged a little bit on this by saying that you don't prove that things are really going to go to hell in 50 years. And the reason I can't prove that is because I have not come back in the future from 50 years. And I try to always say that we have to be modest about what we think we're predicting. And so I would say to the extent that I fail to prove that we are absolutely all going to wind up with, you know, dogs and cats living together and plagues of locusts and rains of frogs and all of that, I think I do fail to prove that because I think it's unprovable. And the best we can do is try to look at things, look at the trends, look at the things that might be problems and have smart conversations about them, which is what I I was hoping my book would do.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about what it is that could turn things in some way, because as you do make this point that the trajectory here is not going to remain constant, and it's hard, as you said, to look forward and project what may happen. But you do mention Poland, for example, and you talk about this decline in their population of something like a quarter that's coming by 2100. And you say that all you need to do to hold that population stable, for example, is for all the little girls in that country today and the women who follow them, all they'd have to do is have an average of about 4 babies each. But then you concede that that's probably not going to happen. So what is it that's going to turn?
Well, we don't know. And what's going to turn is what's going to happen gently over time, because you always have to remember that fertility rates aren't constant across populations.
Yeah.
And so, you know, while for any given country, the fertility rate may be X, once you segment it out into different cohorts, you're going to find high fertility people and you're going to find lower fertility people. And over time, the more fertile people will inherit the earth. I mean, that's how these things work. And that's why we're not looking at like human extinction or anything like that, because, again, there are always going to be people who breed and have kids and people who don't. That is, my buddy Phil Longman, as I said, he's on the other side of the aisle because he's a progressive. And, you know, when he has written about this for places like Foreign Policy, what he suggests is the future is going to be inherited by the politically orthodox. And that a lot of people who are on the left and people who are progressive say, well, hold on a minute. That's not what we like. We don't want a future that is full of the religiously orthodox. And so I say, well, then have more babies. We can have lots of nice NPR listeners in the future. So I like NPR listeners. I would like to have more of them around.
Well, it's funny. So, let me just say this finally. I mean, you say that you hope we'll figure out a way to balance, in fact, liberalism and modern economics and family life. Do you feel hopeful about that?
I don't, but you know what? That could also just be my own disposition. I'm a good Catholic boy, and I'm conservative. And when you put those two things together, you're never hopeful for the future. So I would say I am cautiously pessimistic.
Jonathan Last, his book is called What to Expect When No One's Expecting America's Coming Demographic Disaster. It's the funniest book about demographics there is, by the way. Jonathan Last, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. We invite you to go to our website to continue the conversation, radiowest.kuer.org. I'm Doug Fabrizio.